This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes. Nice
dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello. I'm Anita Rani, and welcome to Woman's Hour from BBC Radio 4. Today, hair. Iconic hairstyles. Your own standout haircut, the Barnet you'll never forget, or indeed you wish you could forget. How do you feel about your hair now? What a haircut or no haircut means to you? The reason I ask is because I'm going to be joined by Susie Ronson, who, as a young hairdresser in Beckenham in the late 60s, got the opportunity to give David Bowie a haircut and colour, or rather, the haircut of Ziggy Stardust. I mean, this haircut was a game changer for him, but also led to Susie getting a job with the band and her life changing overnight, pretty much. But I don't need to give you the details because she will be here to tell her story herself. I would, however, like to know about the style, the haircut that defined or defines you. I've spoken a lot on my own social media about my own hair journey. As a young lass, I had very long hair down to my bottom, but I always loved short hair. But I was always told that long hair was my beauty. So every time I now cut it short, it feels like an act of defiance, which suits my personality. Also, I was desperate for purple hair, but could only ever get purple tops of my ears. But what about you? Your wild, wacky or simple hair stories, please send them in to me the usual way. The text number is 84844, or you can WhatsApp me or voice note me using the number 03700 100 444. You can also email the programme by going to our website. And if you do feel like sending us a photograph via our WhatsApp, you never know, you may end up on our own social media, on the Woman's Hour social media, if we get some real corkers, that is. So your haircut stories, please. Text number 084844 and the WhatsApp number once again, 03700 100 444. Also on the programme, we talk periods during Ramadan with podcasters Maureen Baig and Hawther Ibrahim, and Nail Technicians Unite. We're going to discuss the solidarity for financial support for nail technicians. From Monday, manicurists around the country are raising their prices. But of course, we would like to hear from you throughout the programme, not just about your haircuts, but anything you want to share with us about what you may hear on the show. That text number, once again, 84844. But first, Sunday marks the 30th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide, when in just 100 days in 1994, about 800,000 people were killed by ethnic Hutu extremists. The UN estimates around 250,000 women were raped during the genocide and thousands were kept as sex slaves. Ahead of this anniversary, BBC journalist Victoria Uwahunda made the journey back to Rwanda, where she grew up, for the first time since she and her family were forced to flee the violence when she was only 12 years old. Victoria speaks with people who survived the horrific violence and finds out how the country and its people are healing. And she joins me now in the studio to tell me all about the documentary she's made. Welcome to the programme, Victoria. I listened to it last night. There's a lot to get into. It's a remarkable programme, so well done on making it. But let's go back to what happened. Can you remind us how the genocide began in 1994?
Good morning, Anita, and to your listeners, and thank you so much for having me. So it's a very long history, it's a long story, but I can put it in context as this. So the divisions that led to 1994 genocide were not something that was new. We had lived for so long, we Rwandans, we had lived for so long with these divisions, and they went on ethnic lines. So we have three main ethnic groups in Rwanda. You have the Hutu, who are the majority. Mm-hmm. You have Tutsi, and then you have a group that rarely is spoken about that completely seems to have been forgotten in all of what's happened, the Twa. So those three groups that had lived together for so long, for many years. But then after the First World War, the European countries are now looking to places to go to, places to conquer, and they were dividing among themselves. Rwanda happened to fall under the Belgians. So the Belgians come to Rwanda. They're looking for a people whom they said would be the leaders, the local leaders who can rule while the Belgians are in back in Belgium, but they needed a people that they could trust. And how they did was that they came in and they were looking for people who resembled them. Mm. So if you imagine a Western look, you have a certain way, your nose is, your cheekbones, your forehead, your height. Mm. That was also something that was being used. And at the time when they came, there was one particular group that looked for what they were looking for. And that was what they then just came in and, you know, those were the Tutsi. Then they also introduced these identity cards. And in the identity cards, you have in your ethnicity. And now you have a people who've been now divided. And you have a people who've been given more power. Now you have a monarchy who are in charge. And so the resentment then started festering. So the first waves of violence that we see in Rwanda is in 1959. Mm. And the Hutus revolt. And then they started attacking the Tutsis. And we see tens of thousands of people killed in 1959. Those who survived, they left the country, went into exile in neighboring countries, including Tanzania, Burundi, and in Uganda. And those people who went to Uganda, then they were children then. They left with their parents. Now they are grown-ups. Come 1990, they formed a rebel group. They wanted to come back home by any means. And the first means were to come in by force. So they invade Rwanda, but they are repelled by the then government, which was led by a Hutu. But there are continued fightings around. There are skirmishes. We have a peace talk in Tanzania, many peace talks, actually. And then 1993, a peace deal is agreed between the exiled group, the Rwandan Patriotic Front, and the then government led by President Juvenal Habyarimana. So it was after the latest talks, he flew to Tanzania, Arusha, and he was on the plane coming back with the president of Burundi, 6th of April 1994. The plane is shot down, and that is what most people say is the spark, the ignition of the 1994 genocide.
And people talk about the attack happening and taking place in just 100 days. How was it orchestrated?
So it had been festering along since the 1990 attack. You started hearing certain things on the radio, especially. So it was being broadcast by some extremist radio stations. And words and language that was used at the time was to dehumanize. So you hear lots of words like inyenzi, which is cockroach. We need to finish them off, them being the Tutsis. And they kept repeating that if you don't finish them off, they will come back, because we saw what happened. They left in 1959, they're coming back in 90. It might happen again if we don't finish them off.
And you were only 12 years old. This is when you left. But what do you remember of the sort of rising tensions? What were you aware of before you actually, the violence began?
There wasn't really much talk about that, because the thing that shocks most people is, as you mentioned then, Anita, 100 days. It's a lot of people to kill in that such a short time. But for us, as children, you never really thought about it. But the first time that I truly felt like I was in a place or in a space that wasn't quote-unquote normal, that we had these divisions, was when I was in the fourth grade. So that was 1990. I would have been about nine. And one morning we come into class and we are being told if you're a Hutu, stand on that side. If you're a Tutsi, stand on this side. If you're a Twa, stand on this side. And just shock and bewilderment in all our faces. You know, what's going on? We don't know what we are. And the teacher said calmly, just go home after lunch. Come back and please ask your parents. Now, you don't, as a parent, I don't even remember what they told me to go back and say, but I remember the first thing was, but why? What has this got to do with what you are being taught in class? But, you know, we came back and it was just like, but does it change who we are? Does it change who sits next to me? Does it change who is my friend? But you could already tell, but of course it came after 1990. So whether it had come from up above or somebody was trying to make a list or anything, we will never know. But that was the first time that I realised, hang on.
And there was a legal document for every person in Rwanda saying exactly what tribe you belong to, these ID cards.
The ID cards, yeah.
So what happened to you and your family? When did you, what do you remember, and when did you decide, your family decide that it was time to leave?
So the moment that the plane is shot down, gunfire, bombs, then it's just, it's a blown out war. But at that time, we just don't think, oh, we might not, we are going to die or we are going to have to flee. We're going to have to move. But then in the morning of the 7th, we just decide, okay, listen, we don't know what's going to happen in our neighborhood, but people always feel safety in numbers. So if we go to a friend's house, maybe their neighborhood, and people had already started calling each other. Back in the days when you used to have phones in the house, not mobiles. But they were calling each other, saying, you know, my neighborhood is safe or my neighborhood is unsafe. Can I come to you? So we're moving place to place for the first week. And then on the 12th of April, we ran out of places to go. We ran out of places to feel safe. And the decision was made by the parents, okay, let's all get out of Kigali. So I remember a day that was, it felt endless because it was so many people leaving at the same time. Everybody felt, it felt like everybody was leaving Kigali. People on foot, people on bikes, people, you will see children on the backs of their mothers, their mattresses, belongings on their heads, because it was just like an exodus.
And how did you feel?
I was, you know, I've been thinking about that day. I felt calm, but I didn't know what calm was. But I think I will say I was quiet. Because we didn't know what was happening.
Yeah, I was going to say, did you understand? Did you understand what was actually happening?
No, we were just, we were leaving. What we understood then was we had been told we are seeking shelter, we are seeking refuge and safety because we didn't have any other place to be in Kigali, so we're all moving. But then you will get to people, as I said, people are moving, so many of them, and they'll start, you know, if you roll down your window, you start hearing people say, be careful. We've just heard that down the road there are roadblocks. And you just think, oh, okay. The roadblocks had been set up to literally, as you mentioned, the ID cards. If you had your ID card on you, open it up and it said a certain ethnicity, that was it for you. Or the people who didn't have their ID cards, because most people discarded them once you start hearing that they're checking for ID cards, again, we go back to the looks of people. If you're a tall person, if you had a certain length of nose, if your forehead was, people are even looking at people's gums. Like if it's a certain color, that could be literally decisive of you live or you die.
And how many people in your family trying to escape at this point?
We are in the car now with all my siblings. And I just don't understand how my mom did it because she was driving. And what struck me when I went back was she was the same age at that time that I am now. And I do not know where she got it from, but she was calm. She was collected. Whether she hid it well, but she must have been completely out of her mind because she's in a car with all her children. We are six. Of all ages, and because we had been moving with family and friends, we are in the car with other people. So much responsibility on her shoulders.
It's unimaginable. I mean, I'm sensing fear in my own guts, and you know, it's completely unimaginable. So what took you back 30 years later to make this? And it's the first time you've been back.
Yeah, it's the first time.
To make this documentary. Yeah.
So I just felt that it needed to be told because there are so many people now, it's 30 years, so many people of my generation who need to look back, you know, remember our childhood and the good and the bad, because there's definitely so much bad. But also for the younger generations, I've got nieces and nephews now who are at the age where they just want to know, where do my family come from? What is my legacy? And that was part of me wanting to do it, but also to tell the world that, you know, this happened. And there are so many people who were alive at the time who do not remember it. But especially for the younger generation, you think, if you're 25 now, you probably are hearing this story for the first time. If you're 15, it's completely new world for you. And we are seeing so many conflicts in the world at the moment. And you just think, oh, this is not new. It was happening, and as we saw, happened again in, you know, in the Second World War. And there are so many of these conflicts and events that happened that you just feel like you have to revisit.
What was it like that first half an hour? The plane doors open, you step out, you're on Kigali soil.
Yeah, let me tell you something. I had never set foot at the airport, outside, inside the airport itself, the grounds. I had been at the airport saying goodbye to family, friends who are flying somewhere, but I never flown from it. I'd never seen my birth city, Kigali, from above. But it's known for being foggy, so as we were coming above, I was really annoyed. It's like, you are obstructing my view, you know. But landing down and just the humidity, the smell, the sounds, it's just, I feel home. But I was also saddened for everything that I'd lost, because I'm coming back to where I was born. But I didn't leave by choice. And those moments, you just think to yourself, why all this senseless killing? Why did we have to get to this point of pain and trauma? But it was a good sense to be home, to hear people talk your language, which I hadn't actually realized. I had not had that chance in 30 years to be in a country, in a place where everybody speaks the same language as you. And it's such a wonderful feeling.
And then you did arrive and you spent 5 days interviewing people. And as we know, the violence was horrific. 800,000 people died. And the UN estimates that around 250,000 women were raped during the genocide. Thousands of Tutsi women also taken away to be kept as sex slaves. Did women bear the brunt of the violence?
Oh, absolutely. It's horrific. And also not even in that moment, because that is a trauma that is going to be intergenerational. Women are the ones who are... You are the breadwinner most if you're in rural place. You are the one who is feeding the family. You're the one who is making sure that you can stretch the money for school fees, for healthcare, for everything that your family needs. And having that done to you, there's the trauma that you cannot open up to anybody. And there is so much anger that you see seeping into the family life and the children. And you hear of children having the guilt because they feel like they cannot speak to their parents about that.
After... what took place? The Rwandan government pursued a policy of reconciliation and unity after the genocide. Tell us a bit about that.
It's been a long work. It's been trying to just forget about the divisions, forget about these lines, about ethnicity, about how we are all divided. Because the thing is, there is so much mixing, there's so much intermarriage that happens that you just feel... But who are you exactly killing? You're killing yourselves. So they have this policy called Ndumu Nyarwanda, basically meaning I am Rwandan, to try to make everybody know and think we are here together. We cannot stand to be divided, because the divisions that we live through are the ones that saw our family and friends and everybody killed, everybody dying. And we all live with this trauma from then. But on the other side, you've got people who say, but hang on, I lost my family member. I am a Hutu. When will we ever talk about that? Mm. And you have those critics coming in. There are reports, tens of them from the human rights, you know, organizations who say there were thousands of Hutus who were killed by the Rwandan Patriotic Forces. When will they be remembered? And you keep hearing that. And people keep asking, is it truly reconciliation if people cannot be open? It's a conversation that we need to keep having, because part of the healing, part of it all, is it's a process. It continues.
Well, you talk a lot about, people talk about forgiveness. And before I listened to the documentary, I was reading about what you were doing. And I thought, OK, yes, because we've talked a lot about forgiveness on Woman's Hour and how the act of being able to forgive means that you can move on with your own life and the next generations can move on. But then I listened to your programme. And that's when I really thought, this is something else, because you have a man sitting next to another man who murdered his mother. Now, that must have been an incredibly intense conversation.
Oh, it's everything that touches you as a human. You hear these stories and you think, when I was watching these two men, Evariste and Narcisse, and I'm looking in their eyes and I'm thinking, where do you get this strength? Where do you get the grace to be so... You extend a hand, and that was powerful for me to hear, to listen, to have that in my mind, to think, oh, maybe I should be giving more people, you know, more grace, more, just think of the things that we take for granted as the tiniest thing is going to annoy you for all, you know, all your day, all your week. And yet here are these two people sitting together despite what they've been through. And they're forgiven, but they haven't forgotten, but they're forgiven.
But then I was really astounded by another woman who you interviewed called Claudette. And I mean, it was just the idea that she could forgive when she was so... she was wounded and they attempted to kill her so many times. And then we find out that she was only 13.
Yeah.
That really, you know, made me, I had to pause at that point.
Yeah. No, I was lost for words because I was sitting next to her when she's telling or retelling all this trauma and her voice is breaking all along. And in my journalist's head, I'm thinking, Vic, remain objective, but just remember to ask her how old she was, because up until that point, she hadn't mentioned how old she was, and I couldn't look at her face and know how old she is now to kind of gauge. Just without even asking, she says, I was only 13. In the raw tape, there is a moment where nobody speaks. Literally, you could hear a pin drop. And that's when I literally was broken myself, because I was only 12. So everything she's told up to that point and everything she's telling now again, I'm not seeing her as she says, I ran from this house to that house. I had wound here, I had wound there. I'm seeing me. It could have easily been me. But yet she's sitting here telling her story and the strength and the grace that she extended one of her attackers. And he was in the room with us. It was quite powerful.
He was in the room with you.
He was. He was.
Has there been a push from the Rwandan government to hold the perpetrators of rape accountable?
They have. So they treated all the assaults, whether you killed somebody, whether you raped somebody, or you maimed somebody. Everybody went, if you were caught, you went through a system. So we have the Gachacha system, court hearings, which are traditional court hearings, because there were so many perpetrators that as we know, you know, the Western way of knowing the courts, they were not going to be enough. So there were more of the Gachacha courts that were set up because they realized that they had to process all these people. They had to hold them to account for what they did. And those ones were actually more powerful because it was community-based. It would be in your neighborhood, in your local area, where you could come face-to-face with the people that you had wronged.
I mean, it is really... A remarkable documentary. And if you are interested, I urge you to listen to the full version of Victoria's story, and you can search for it for Rwanda 30 Years On wherever you find your podcast. But very quickly, I know you were out there for 5 days and you had your producer journalist head on and you were running around doing all these interviews. And I can see there's, you know, we're talking about it. It's a very intense environment in the studio and there's tears in your eyes. You've obviously had time to reflect. So how do you feel about your experience now?
I found it cathartic, to be honest with you, Anita, because I was able to make peace, quote unquote, with, you know, what I'd lost, you know, what I'd left behind, and also realizing that it will still forever be my home, but it is no longer my home because I did not get to grow up in there. I did not get to fully immerse myself into what could have been, but it's still home. You know, with all that comes with it, with the dark history, it is still my home. And the resilience that the Rwandan people continue to show today, whether you are inside or outside, is remarkable.
Thank you very much for coming in to speak to me.
Thank you for having me.
As I said, you can search for Rwanda 30 Years On and you will find it there.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
84844 is the number to text. Lots of you getting in touch to tell me about your hairstyles. Wendy says, my hairstyle in the 60s was styled on the iconic Kathy McGowan long hair full fringe look. I've always tried different colours on my hair, and during lockdown I grew it long. I'm 76 and my hair is now shiny plummy purple. Sounds gorgeous. I love it and have no idea what my real colour is, probably very white. Valerie in Essex says, in 1983, the days of big hair, after a six hours at the hairdresser to perm and highlight my shoulder length hair, it ended up so high that I couldn't fit in the car. Was it a mini? I had to recline the seat and open the sunroof, stop it, to be able to drive home. I loved it. Still try to finger dry as much as possible. Keep into my now grey hair. Keep them coming in. And as I said, if you want to send us your photos, please do. And we might put them up on our own WhatsApp. The reason I'm asking is because of my next guest. Because lots of our favourite pop or rock stars have had iconic hair looks. Emma Bunton, Baby Spice, with those pigtails. Justin Bieber with the swept across hairstyle. My own favourite, Annie Lennox, with her short crop blonde. My next guest is the woman behind a hairstyle many of us will recognise. The red spiky hair of Ziggy Stardust, a character and onstage persona created by David Bowie. Susie Ronson is the hairdresser who created that look with David. Well, she's now written a memoir, Me and Mr. Jones, My Life with David Bowie and the Spiders from Mars, all about how her life changed after meeting David's mother and his then wife, Angie. Her time with the band during the 70s and meeting her late husband, guitarist Mick Ronson. Susie, welcome to Woman's Hour.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for having me on.
I mean, you talk hair, everybody wants to get involved. Let's start with the haircut. Where did the inspiration for the Ziggy Stardust hairstyle come from, and how did you create it?
Well, I met David. I'd met his mother, I met his wife. I got invited to Haddon Hall, which was where they were living. And David, as I walked in, David was sitting in a bay window flipping through a magazine. And he had long blonde hair at the time. His wife, Angie Bowie, was discussing the merits of cutting his hair short because nobody had short hair. And I said, well, no one's got short hair. I mean, nobody did. It Beatles, Rolling Stones. And we'd come from the hippies in the 60s, so short hair definitely wasn't in. So he came over and showed me a photograph in a magazine of a girl with short red spiky hair. And he said to me, can you do that? As I'm saying yes, I'm thinking to myself, that's a girl's hairstyle. And wasn't quite sure how I would do it. But I was confident. You know, I thought he was a perfect person to have really short hair. Tall, rock star thing, long white neck, great face. I mean, if I could pull it off, it would look really good. We cut it that night. The style was good, but it wouldn't stand up. It just kind of kept flopping to one side. He looked like a schoolboy. And he didn't look too happy, you know, and I didn't feel too great about it either. But I said, listen, the second we get some colour in this, it's going to change the texture and it will stand up. I was praying I was right.
And it worked.
Well, it did eventually, yes.
Eventually.
It did.
Now, you say that you were just there in Haddon Hall, but actually, what's so charming about this story is how it begins, which is you as a young girl working in this hair salon in Beckenham, and how it was David Bowie's mum's hair that you were doing. And then one day she brought her daughter-in-law in, David's wife.
That's right.
And she, you said, was this exotic, glamorous.
She was American. That was number one. Mm. In 1971 in Beckenham, you didn't meet many Americans. And she was tall and glamorous and she wore fabulous clothes. You didn't buy clothes like that in Beckenham either. So very unusual girl.
I got a sense that, you know, you were craving, desperate for something different because she came
craving
in to get a haircut. And I think, you know, this story, you created your own destiny. Because you,
I did. Yeah, I've been looking for something. Mm. I've been to Italy when I was 17 for 6 months. I've been to America when I was 20. I was looking for something. I did not want to live the life of my parents.
And you got you something, didn't you?
And I got my something. Yes, I did.
Because you ran after her and said, because she wanted a haircut, there were no appointments, and you said, it's okay. And she said, well, come, I can do
it
at your house.
I got to Haddon Hall, yes.
And you had some help come up with looks for not just David. Tell us about the boys from Hull.
Well, they were boys from Hull. You know, they weren't really like David and his friends. They were regular guys, which made me feel a bit more comfortable, in actual fact.
We're talking about his backing band here.
Yeah,
the
they were just
Mars.
So. I did. I think the most distinctive one out of the three was Trevor Boulder, the bass player. He ended up with blue black hair with spikes on top, and he had those big silvery whiskers. But at first, I mean, Woody was asked to wear, the Woody the drummer was asked to wear a pink costume. And David said to him, it takes a real man to wear pink. And he did, and the makeup was another thing. They didn't want to wear makeup at first, and then it was like, oh, have you got me mascara? You know, they were in the dressing room putting on the makeup. So it took them not that long to slip into those costumes and the makeup.
I love the contrast in the book between your home life and then you stepping into Haddon Hall and all these characters and people that you would never have come across in your day-to-day
existence. I thought I was on the moon. It was a completely different world. They lived in a completely different world to me.
You write about the first UK tour you accompanied them on, being in places like Bournemouth, Doncaster, all the glamorous places. Donny, Woman's Hour, went to Donny a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
And the kids outside who tried to replicate the haircut that you'd created.
I mean, some of them did a good job, but sometimes like a 200-pound trucker with David Bowie hair looks a little odd. Big hairy guy, you know, with this little red haircut. But bless them, they tried, you know, they wanted something. I think England at that time was pretty grey. I think it was a pretty grey place. So David put a huge burst of colour into the pop scene.
And then you moved, well, it sounds like in the book, so seamlessly into creating costumes, makeup, styling, even getting the band members onto stage. How did you become so integral to the whole?
I wanted to keep my job. And just being able to do the hair was not going to be enough. So I wanted to be on the road. I wanted to have my own wages, my own room, my own per diem. And I just knew I had to expand my usefulness. So I did pretty much, you know, got the drinks, got the cigarettes. Besides, when you're in a town, those guys couldn't go out and get what they wanted. They looked too extraordinary. So I would go do their shopping for them, get them what they wanted, shaving cream, razors, whatever it was. And yes, coffee, drinks, cigarettes, whatever they wanted.
Well, in the book, you call yourself the tour madam.
Oh, my God, was that an unfortunate tour of choice of words?
Yeah, go on,
I christened myself tour madam. I wasn't procuring people to come back to the band like that. But at the end, you know, when they got so famous, they couldn't stay in the theatre. We had to rush them out and rush them off.
I'm going to bring the listeners up to speed here, Susie, because they might not have read any of the interviews or read the book yet, which, you know, you will read and you'll enjoy it. But you describe yourself as tour madam in the book. And you write about bringing a girl who it turned out was only 16 to
That's
David.
Right, yes.
And then having to get her out of the room because a mum arrived at the hotel. And of course, in light of all the allegations of him having sex with underage girls at the time, which came to light after he died. I mean, like you said it yourself, oh gosh, why did I, you know.
Well, yeah, but I mean, he didn't have sex with her. When I went knocked on the door, she's the one that said, oh, my mother, she's come here to spoil my fun. I mean, that girl was ready to stay and she didn't look 16. Mm. You know, girls don't when they're in full makeup and their dresses and their hair. And why wasn't she with somebody?
Well, her mum did turn up, as you say in the book.
She was going to pick her up outside, yeah.
How do you reflect on that time and the culture around it?
It was a different time. I mean, now, if I think it was been my daughter, of course, I'd be horrified. So it was a different time is really all I can say. I think the groupies in LA were 14, 15 years old. Even that shocked me, but...
Well, it is
everyone. It is shocking, right? But they were so young. But no one seemed to be shocked, except for me, really. I was like, well, where's their mother? Oh, she dropped them off. She wants them to have a good time. And I'm like, wow. It was very different time.
What was your relationship like with David?
My relationship with David, very professional, really. I mean, I was professional. I was with him a lot, obviously, during the shows, changing his clothes, making sure he had everything he needed. But those shows were fierce. I mean, that was a lot of work for him to do. And my job was to make it as easy for him as possible.
We've got to talk about your own love story as well, which happened in the backdrop of all of this, because you met your late husband, Mick Ronson. Your darling husband,
yes.
When he was in The Spiders from Mars.
When I first met him, I thought he was absolutely gorgeous. But I didn't want that. I wanted the job. I didn't want to be... I knew that having, you know, being a boyfriend, it wasn't going to work. But after David had broken up the band, Mick and I got together and became romantic and fell in love in Italy. It was a wonderful moment for me. He was a great bloke.
What's it been like? What was the experience like writing it? And now that it's out in the world, people reading your story?
It's been pretty cathartic for me. I could never talk about Mick without crying, to be honest. Even after all this time, even now. But I think it's been pretty cathartic for me. I never did marry again. I mean, I've had my relationships, but I never did marry again. He was one in a million, my husband.
And when you think back at that time and that experience...
Wasn't I lucky? Wasn't I a lucky girl? I mean, I know I made the most of it, and I did, but wasn't I lucky to have got that chance and been able to do that? Travelling with those guys, and then afterwards being involved in music, the Rolling Thunder Review, Bob Dylan. What an amazing time that was for me. I was very lucky.
Susie's name dropped a couple there, but there's plenty more in the book.
Yes.
Susie Ronson, thank you so much for coming.
Well, thank you so much for having me on.
It's a great read, Me and Mr. Jones, My Life with David Bowie and the Spiders from Mars from Susie Ronson. I'm going to get you a tissue and we'll get you a nice cup of tea as well, because we can do that at Woman's Hour.
Thank you so much.
And people are still getting in touch with their hairstyles. So
let's
read a few more out. Amanda's emailed in to say, my mum was also a hairdresser in Beckenham. Hang on, you might know each other. A little later than when David Bowie, but just as adventurous with hairstyles. I was not Ziggy Stardust, but my fave hairstyle was a pre-Raphaelite look, permed and hennaed red. My mum said she'd never tried perm and henna, and if my hair fell out, we could always cut it all off. I said, let's do it. It worked, and I looked like I'd walked straight out of a Rossetti painting. How beautiful. In the 80s, all of the 80s stories, I had bright orange Bowie-esque hair, and then I had cropped and peroxided. It took the stylist hours to get the orange out. Sam in Cumbria says, I've always had short hair, even as a child, until the COVID pandemic, when I finally grew it out due to no haircuts. Now I have long, thick hair with no greys at 51. It's a whole new world. No greys at 51? What are you doing?
Can't imagine that.
That's what we want to know. What's the secret? Susie, thank you.
You're welcome.
84844, keep your thoughts coming in. Now, what's it like being a woman in Ramadan? Ramadan, of course, is the month-long period of fasting observed by Muslims all over the world. It happens once a year, and we're currently just 4 days away from Eid at the end of Ramadan. It's estimated that there are around 1.9 billion people around the world who are followers of Islam, which means roughly 800 million women. So what happens when they have to do a month of fasting? And what about when they go through what many women go through once a month, about when they get their periods? Earlier, I was joined by presenter and former teacher Maureen Begg and podcast host Hawtha Ibrahim to talk about just this. I started by asking Maureen why she decided to make her Ramadan podcast Not Even Water.
When I left teaching and I joined TV, I faced so much scrutiny, and it was a real shock because all of a sudden people were treating me like a spokesperson for every Muslim in the world. And it was, I had to do a lot of research because I'd get invited to places and people would ask me questions. And over the last few years, I feel like the climate has really changed, and there's even more scrutiny on Islam, on Muslim women, and people are too afraid to talk about religion and faith. And whether that's someone, if you're someone of faith and you're, it's kind of a really awkward topic sometimes. Or if you're somebody who has questions, you've got to... I was born and brought up in London, so it was very, very diverse. But there are communities around the UK who've never even met a Muslim, and the only things they get to hear about Muslims are things they see on the news. And I feel like Not Even Water is a really fun and light way to talk about Islam, to talk about faith and how young British Muslims are navigating their faith with their everyday lives, but in a really honest and judgment-free way. So it's a great platform for British Muslims to share their stories, but it's also a great place for people to learn more about the religion.
What do you think people's perception is of Muslim women, young Muslim women?
I think it's growing. I think the conversation is getting a lot wider with culture and discussions that we have online. I think there's social media has helped a lot, having a lot of influencers and like content creators and people in media, a lot of Muslim women kind of speaking out a bit more. I think generally people feel like there's kind of like a little facade on us, like we're kind of timid, we don't have opinions. You know, our lives are completely different and they're really not.
So if anybody does think that young Muslim women don't have opinions, then you really do need to listen to this podcast. Maureen, you brought up the fact that you were a teacher and then you had this incredible broadcasting career, which is still ongoing. I was going to talk to you about that later, but you brought it up straight away. So a lot of pressure on your young shoulders, and a lot of it, and probably exposed in a way that you weren't expecting to be exposed. Do you feel now doing this that you have sort of ownership over who you are and how you present and what you can and can't say?
100%. It was so difficult because I think naturally when you in your life, you surround yourself with groups and circles of people who have similar viewpoints to yourself. And that's just the circles you grow up and move within. And all of a sudden, when I started my broadcasting career, I had half of the people watching my shows who weren't Muslim, who were like, she's trying to convert everyone and she's trying to make everyone Muslim. And this is BBC's propaganda. Get her off our screen. Go back to where you came from. I was born in Hackney. Where do you want me to go back to? Mm. And then you had the other half of people who were watching the show who were from the Muslim community. And they were like, she doesn't represent us. She doesn't wear a hijab. She has her nails done. She can't be Muslim. It's like, I didn't know what I was in for. And no matter what I said, I could never get it right. I could never get it right. There was always somebody who was unhappy. And I feel like not even water, where I get to do something where it's not scripted, no one writes my commentary for me. And even if I got to look over the commentary, this is purely my words. These are my conversations. Anything I say, I can stand by. Whether I face backlash for it or not, at least I know it was truly me having a conversation. And actually, the most special part of it is meeting incredible young women like yourself who I feel like are so much more ready to speak about their experiences than maybe I was sort of in my 20s when I joined telly. I was really trying to get it right for so many years. And it's only now where I'm like, actually, I'm just going to tell my story authentically as my story. And that's what these young women are already doing. And I think it's the most beautiful thing to see.
Well, it is a great, joyful episode that you're here to talk about, which is episode 3 of the 3rd series. And it starts off with a really important question about Ramadan and being on your period. Why did you want to discuss this?
I just feel like I often think about, if I was a young woman listening to this podcast, what kind of conversations would benefit me? Would it kind of help me to listen to and get some answers from? And also I feel like if it would help me, then it would help other women listening. But it's not just to help people, it's also to normalize these conversations. And it's also, I just feel like they're valid questions that even people who aren't Muslim might have. But how do you really ask someone and go up to a Muslim and say, hey, Muslim colleague, just wondering about periods, let's have a chat. So when it's wrong, you wouldn't. It'd be very, very difficult.
It would be a very awkward water cooler conversation to be having.
This is the podcast and hear a group of people talking about it.
Hawthorne, what are the rules? What are the rules about being on your period?
You know what's so interesting, before I get into the rules, I think it's something that Mahareen touched on. It's actually quite hilarious how often you get asked, oh, why are you not fasting today? Or what's going on? And I think having these sort of conversations on a podcast space in a very friendly, not intensive way, it kind of helps people navigate those conversations without feeling awkward and just feel relaxed and understand and like take informative information in. So in terms of the rules, I would say for Ramadan, obviously if a woman is on her period, she is not obliged to fast. That's obviously one of the mercies that we have from God, essentially, because he obviously knows what we go through with our bodies. You already know what periods are like, the PMS, the pain, the trauma, just the constant emotions that go up and down. Yeah, you need nutrients. So obviously I think that's one of the great mercies that we have, to not be able to fast. And obviously we will need to repay those days. But again, it's not something that you have to do within a month. You can do that within the full lunar cycle, so just before the next Ramadan in the year.
So you make up the days. What I particularly enjoyed was at the top of this particular podcast where Mahareen, you said you feel really guilty, and Hawthorne, you don't feel any guilt at all.
There was such outrage at me saying I feel guilty. I was like, guys, I didn't mean like there's this great shame. Like,
no, I meant,
all the time when I don't pray, I feel really sad that I'm not actually praying, and I feel really left out. And I think somebody in the comment section really summed it up beautifully, and they were like, guys, I think she means feels like FOMO, like fear of missing out. And I'm like, it's true. I didn't feel like I hide in a corner and I can't tell. I meant, I feel like, oh God, I should be doing this. And I really want to be doing this. And I'm sad that I'm not going to be able to fast with everybody. And it was so taken out of context. I thought it was hilarious, but it always is. If you say it like, yeah.
Just because it is Woman's Hour and we've got a huge audience listening to us, what are you missing out on?
I think what she means is, and I experienced this the first week of Ramadan because I was on my period, I think Ramadan is such a special month, and I think it's so spiritually enriching that you feel like, oh my God, I want to be able to pray, I want to be able to do the things that I need to do, compared to everyone else. That's fasting and praying at the time. But I think one thing that Maharin summed up quite well is, and I think we explained in the podcast, is just because you're on your period and you're not physically doing the act of physical prayer, you can still make supplication, you can still do the other things that enrich your soul, and you kind of still get that spiritual feeling as well without having to do the physical activity. But I did feel this way the first week of Ramadan when everyone in my household was fasting, and I was just sitting there like, yeah, what do we do? I'm really missing out on the spiritual aspect.
But and I think also you're, because you're in a routine, and if you have been you've been fasting for like a couple of weeks and you're really in it and you're used to, like, every night I'm doing this intense prayer, and every like sunrise I'm doing this prayer, and I'm, and then suddenly you stop and you're like, I don't have to wake up now. It feels strange. It does feel a little bit weird. It's a little bit like I should be doing it, even though you know you don't have to. You know you can rest and relax and all of that. For me personally, I just feel a little bit like I lose my bearings a little bit, but it's something I really want to be doing. And when I'm not doing it, it just makes me feel like, oh, I wish I was.
Yeah. And that also describes your level of faith as well, which is really inspiring, because often faith goes up and down. It's not something that's quite linear. And to be feeling that way constantly and having like FOMO or guilt or unbalancedness, I feel like that's a good thing, because I feel like you're spiritually there.
I don't know about you guys, but I grew up in a South Asian family, in a Punjabi family. I'm a bit older than you, quite a bit older. And talking about periods was just a big no-no culturally. So you got the religion on one side, but culturally, it was just not something that's talked about. Even now, I think the conversation is only just starting to happen with the younger generation. Do you feel like you are really pushing the agenda as young Muslim women?
I remember a scenario just starting out my fasting. I think I was like 16, and I think one of my uncles came back from home to visit us, and I was casually eating in the kitchen. He was like very shocked by it. No, I wouldn't say appalled, but he was just like, please, like, don't eat in front of us, don't eat in the kitchen, sort of thing. But, like, I just felt shameful to think, oh my god, like, maybe I shouldn't be eating in the comfort of my home. And I think now that's something we discuss on our podcast. It's just the idea that because we've been given this break, it isn't, being on your period isn't an impurity. Like, it's not shameful. It's a natural thing. People have it. We're all grown ups. We've had these discussions. And I just think, yeah, it's a taboo subject that people, it's strange to say that it's a taboo subject, because it's something so normal for women. But I think in spaces of like culture, especially around men in our societies, I feel like it's something that it's hard for them to grasp. It's like an icky thing that they don't want to discuss.
I feel like periods and just women's, I mean, anything to do with women's health and women's sexuality, and I think they are kind of taboo or not talked about even outside of the South Asian community.
Correct.
And you're right, 100%. It probably is a bit like more within the South Asian community. But so when I was fasting a couple of weeks ago, I saw a colleague, and he's not South Asian, and he said, oh, you're not fasting then? And I said, no, I'm on my period. And maybe I do subconsciously do it on purpose, like I do say it out loud on purpose. And maybe you're right, maybe now I'm thinking about it, I think I do. I kind of not enjoy making people uncomfortable, but I quite like to push the boundaries in that way. I'm like, yeah, I'm on my period. You shouldn't really ask women why they're not fasting, darling. And you could see he was visibly quite uncomfortable by it. But also, yeah, in my house, we never grew up talking about periods or sex. I'm 34. We still don't. And I think when you say that, people are like, again, people really jump to, oh, her house must be so strict. My mum thinks armpit is a rude word. I said armpit the other day. She's like, don't say that. Like, they're really strange. I mean, and me and my sister really do take the mix. So sometimes if we like, we'll be around the house and we'll just be like vagina or something. And my mum's like, stop. But it's hilarious. It's really, really funny. And my dad's in on it. And it's not because we live in some insanely backward kind of house. My mum just feels, because she is from that generation where they really didn't talk about any of that stuff. So yeah, I learned about periods and all of that from Judy Blume books growing up, and I'm really glad that now people can listen to the podcast and learn a bit more from that.
And I bet there's an army of young women who are delighted that this podcast exists, because obviously you have to live as young Muslim women in your country in different worlds. You have to live in different spheres and adapt depending on what sphere you're in. So Hotha, how do you find, I mean, it's a huge question, but being a young Muslim woman in Britain?
You know what? It's a big question. I love it and I dislike it sometimes. I love it because I grew up here, I was educated here, I work here. I feel like it's a part of my personality and my identity as a British Muslim woman. At times, the many things that I don't like is the idea that I'm scrutinized. There's a lot of bias around me. I have to watch what I say, the way I talk, the way I look. It's sad that if I get on a bus and, you know, people don't want to sit next to me. Do you know what I mean? It's things like that, that kind of, you kind of recognize yourself as being different. And it's not a nice feeling to have constantly, to be aware of yourself and your safety and your security. I think things are changing. There's a lot of conversations. I think Muslim women are coming into huge media spaces now. There's a lot of representation on TV, on the BBC, on media, everywhere. And I think that's really important because it kind of just shows we are human. You know, we have opinions like everyone else. But I think overall, it's been very positive. And I'm really proud to be a British Muslim woman.
Hotha Ibrahim and Mehreen Beg there. And all three series of Not Even Water are available on BBC Sounds. Now, a study conducted by the Nail Tech organisation, an online learning community for people in the industry, shows that the UK average lies at around £40. But their research has also revealed that only £7 of that goes to the nail technician when costs are deducted, meaning they're often earning less than minimum wage. Because of this, manicurists around the country are increasing their prices on Monday in a sign of solidarity for more financial support in the sector. Well, to discuss this, I'm joined by Amy Guy, the founder of the Nail Tech Org, and Rochelle Anthony, owner of Doll's House Salon in Milton Keynes, and also the runner-up on The Apprentice last year. Welcome to both of you. Amy, I'm going to come to you first. Tell us about your research. What were your findings when it came to nail techs?
Hello, and good morning to everyone as well. Thank you so much for having me. At the Nail Tech Org, we are home to thousands of nail technicians, and we recently did some research around the sort of financial information of our members, of how long they were spending with each client, what were the general costs of each treatment, and essentially what they were taking home per hour as a wage. And we were so shocked when we understood that the average was just under £7 per hour as a profit take home for the nail technician. We have understood for a long time that pricing, you know, it's always been something that, as a standard, and it'd be interesting to hear what Rochelle thinks of this too, but nail technicians tend to join the industry, maybe have a little look at what everybody else is charging around them, and then maybe charge around the same or maybe even a little bit less because they're new to the industry. And I think because of that, it's led us to the position that we're in now, where we knew that it was a problem, but not as much as what we actually found when we really did the research. So we just felt like we needed to do something that was really going to encourage a shift in the industry that really needs to happen for us to remain sustainable.
Come on then, Rochelle, how do you set your prices? What do you look at?
So very similar to obviously what Amy said, is I will look at what the norm is in the area. But I think it's beautiful what Amy's doing. I think as an industry, we need to collaborate over competition and we need to charge our worth. You know, there's a few people in the industry that will always undercut, but I think if we come together, we're going to actually make sure that people take our industry seriously. It's something I harp on about all the time. You know, we are skilled people. We are doing a service that is a luxury-based service. So if we don't charge what we're worth, then you will find that people will just always expect the same. We are feeling the cost of living crisis. We are also paying through the nose for products. And if you want a luxury-based service, I think this whole movement is just stunning to see. And I've always, always harped on about collaboration over competition. So again, you know, we look at what the pricing structure is in other salons, but if we set the bar a little bit higher, it just allows us to actually work for our passion, make a net profit, and not just do it as a hobby.
And this is an industry, as we all know, that is predominantly run by women, for women. So now it's a yes, absolutely. No one saw that, but we might put the clip up, but you did a nice hand gesture there. Tell us about the increase day then. What are your price rise recommendations, Amy?
So I think It's really important within this message that we understand that every single business is different. Every business has different costs. Obviously, Rochelle is running salons, which would be slightly different to a standard self-employed nail technician. And I think that is the point of this movement, is that those costs, regardless of who you are and how you're running your business, have to be considered when you are creating your treatment menu, creating your price list. And so there isn't really any right or wrong in terms of what your prices should be. They just have to consider all of your business costs and actually give you a profit that is more than minimum wage by the time you've done the treatments and divided that.
What would you like to see happen on this day?
I would absolutely love for nail technicians to finally be earning the wage that they should be earning. You know, it is not an easy job and we work so, so hard. It just seems to be the one beauty treatment. I know there are a couple of others, but mainly nails, that just hasn't increased in price along with everything else around us. And so I would love on Monday for nail techs to just finally see that shift.
Rochelle, what are going to be the long-term benefits of increasing manicurist income?
Well, as you all know, when you have a salon, it has so many different price points and factors to it. And when you have a nail tech, they are literally visible all the time. I'm such a hand talker. You guys can't see that, but I'm always talking with my hands. And this is a physical
hands,
thing.
Hands and exquisite nails, may I add.
It's all part of, you know, your general well-being. So it's not just an external factor, it's an internal factor. And that price, you know, you could charge thousands for it, but people at home that don't do the beauty industry don't realize, and I've always said it, nail technicians are worth their weight in gold. They are using 3-4 different products on their nails. They're using cuticle oils and they last for a good 3 to 4 weeks. So when you actually break it down, if we collectively come together and charge a higher price point, what's then going to happen is people will start to see the worth. And that is the product that we have to do, is value. Nail technicians don't cut any corners. They physically can't. They can't start using an inferior product because it's not going to last as long. But if we actually set up a price point from the initial, the beginning, and say, this is what we're going to be charging, then no one ever can argue with that. But you know, it's such a hard thing because I don't want to pass that cost on to everybody at home because they are also feeling that cost of living crisis. But it's got to happen. It's got to be done. So, yeah, I'm very much in agreement with it. And I hope to see it happen and everyone collectively come together to do it.
How will you make sure that this is going to happen, Amy?
Well, I think we already have, to be fair. The hard work has been done. We've been working so hard to just spread awareness around this. We've educated over 5,000 nail techs in the UK with our free masterclass, which is still ongoing if anybody is listening and wants to be a part of it. My Instagram, the Nail Tech Org's Instagram handle, you'll get the link in there. So we've educated over 5,000 nail techs so far, but we know there are so many who've sort of skipped the masterclass and just gone straight ahead.
Well, you know, it'd be interesting to see what happens after Monday and how... I mean, how the industry responds, but also then how the customer base, the predominantly female customer base, reacts to it. Thank you both for coming on and talking to me about that, Amy Guy and Rochelle Anthony. And thanks to all of you who've been getting in touch with your great hair stories. Margaret says, this is my 74th birthday and my hair is still black. No grey hair. I can't take credit for it. It's my genes. Someone else has said, I once went green for a Halloween party to join work with the festivities. I used a laughably named wash-in, wash-out colour. Unfortunately, I was green for St Patrick's Day despite my best efforts. Never again. That's all for today's Woman's Hour. Join us again next time.
Hi, this is Kirsty Young. I just wanted to let you know that Young Again, my podcast for BBC Radio 4, is back.
I'm telescoping two bits of this story together.
That's okay. It's only memory.
It's only show bits. We can say what we like.
In Young Again, we're joined by some of the world's most intriguing people.
Bill was the CEO at Microsoft at the time.
And I ask a simple question. If you knew then what you know now, what would you tell yourself?
Be very, very careful about the people you surround yourself with.
I gave too much power to people who didn't deserve it.
Subscribe to Young Again on BBC Sounds. I'm looking forward to your company.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.